Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. And we begin today, as we do most Fridays, with a roundup of news from across Illinois. In a few minutes, we'll go to our regular reporter roundtable rotation, this week focusing on what's news in the communities of Champaign-Urbana, Macomb, and Galesburg. But first, we begin with a story that made national news out of Peoria.
At least 8 people are shot, 2 dead at 3 different crime scenes.
Peoria's police chief says finding those responsibles is a, quote, all hands on deck situation.
We are losing too many young lives and we need your help. Please speak up, share information, and help take our communities back by helping end this senseless violence.
My soul is okay, but my heart is hurting, you know, and it's hurting for my city.
There are layers to this story and to the broader problem of violence in downstate cities. So in order to give it the attention it deserves, we plan to return to this story next week on Tuesday. We also want to address another tragic story from earlier this week. On Sunday, a U.S. Marine Corps aircraft crashed during routine training exercises in Australia. There were many injuries among the 23 people on board. 3 were killed, including a former resident of Belleville, Illinois, in the Metro East region near St. Louis. Joining me now to talk about this is Will Bauer, who covers Metro East for St. Louis Public Radio. Will, welcome back to the 21st Show.
Thanks for having me.
So what do we know about the incident?
Yeah, so Eleanor Cook, or formerly LeBeau, as she would have been known in Belleville before she was married, she was a pilot of an Osprey that crashed in Australia's Northern Territory on Sunday morning. And for those that don't know, an Osprey is like if you combined a helicopter and an airplane. So the propellers spin parallel to the ground before takeoff, like a helicopter, but then they would rotate forward while they're flying, spin perpendicular to the ground, kind of like an airplane. And the Marine Corps said the flight was a routine training exercise. It was drill being run in conjunction with the militaries of Australia, Indonesia, and the Philippines. So on the Osprey, there were a total of 23 people. Cook was one of the 3 that didn't survive the crash. The other 20 were all injured and taken to an Australian hospital.
What else can you tell us about Captain Cook?
Yeah, she grew up here in Belleville, which is about 20 miles east of St. Louis, if you're not familiar with the area. She went to Catholic schools here. She later attended Murray State University in Kentucky, where she graduated in 2016. In 2018, she enlisted in the Marine Corps, and she later got married to her husband Chase, and she was 29 at the time of the crash last week.
And she was a pilot, a Marine Corps aviator, right?
Yes, she was.
So what has been the response from her family?
Yeah, her mother told the Belleville News Democrat, a local newspaper here that St. Louis Public Radio are partners with, that she was very proud of her daughter and that by giving her life, she had helped save those 20 others. And there's been a ton of other condolences offered to the families of the Marines that died, you know, from Marine Corps leadership to Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin to President Joe Biden. And also, as standard procedure, the Marines said they would investigate the cause of the crash. As of now, nothing has been released. The acting Marine Corps general also ordered a review of the Corps' process to ensure a culture of safety. That review was ordered to be complete by September 15th, or 2 weeks from now. And kind of the context here, why something like that may need to be done, or at least looked into, the Marine Corps Times and the Associated Press reported there's been a total of 5 other fatal Osprey crashes in the Marine Corps since 2012. Those other 5 crashes resulted in 12 other deaths.
Yeah, since 2012. And I know there have been problems with the Osprey going back even further than that. So it's something that certainly bears watching. You mentioned some of the reaction coming in from different levels of government in the community. I saw the White House even tweeted about this. What did they have to say?
Yeah, President Joe Biden, he had said Jill, his wife, the first lady, and he sent their deepest condolences to the families of the Marines who lost their life, and they're praying for those who also suffered injuries.
Will Bauer covers Metro East for St. Louis Public Radio. Will, thank you for taking the time to speak with us about Captain Ellie Cook.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to transition now to talking about what's making news in other parts of the state. And today, as part of our regular reporter roundtable rotation, we're focusing on the communities of Macomb and Galesburg, and the region, I should say, and the communities of Champaign-Urbana. Joining me now is Rich Egger, news director at WIUM, Tri-State's Public Radio. Rich, welcome. Good to talk with you again.
Hey, it's good to talk to you, Brian. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. And also joining us, Emily Hayes, who is an education reporter, I should say the education reporter at our home station, Illinois Public Media News. Emily, welcome back to the 21st Show.
Thanks, Brian.
So, Emily, I want to begin with you. This week we saw the start of hearings in Piatt County with regards to a proposed wind farm. What did we learn from that?
So my colleague Jim Meadows has been following the debate over wind farms in Piatt County. So they previously rejected a proposal by Virginia-based Apex Clean Energy. Now the same company is back with a slightly smaller project, 50 instead of 60 turbines. But now the local government's hands are tied. There's a new state law that sets standards for wind farms, where local governments basically have to approve as long as it meets those standards. So those locally that have been opposed to this have been worried about noise and light pollution. For example, the lights for warning lights for airplanes when they fly by. They are looking at the proposal again. They have scheduled 8 hearings through mid-September before they make their final decision. And by the way, Apex says this would generate enough energy each year to power approximately 99,000 homes. For context, that's a little bit more than all the homes in Champaign County, according to the U.S. Census.
Interesting. Yeah, you certainly see those complaints about noise pollution or, and I guess the flashing lights we see from the side of the highway. So that'll be something that bears watching as we move ahead. Rich, I want to turn to you now. Sticking with local government news, maybe Macomb is going to be hosting a special census or putting on a special census in the fall, I guess, of next year. Why is that happening?
It's happening because it happens about every 10 years in Macomb. The census is done. The city disagrees with the figures and they ask for a special census. Keep in mind, normally the census is done in April every 10 years. That's when enrollment is a little bit lower at Western Illinois University than it typically is in the fall. So then the city asks for a special census to be done in the fall of a particular year, hoping enrollment is up a little bit at that time and that they can get a little higher population figure. Of course, the federal government uses census figures to determine its distribution of funding for hundreds of programs. That's why this is important to the city. Also keep in mind that when the census was done in 2020, we had a pandemic going on. Students were at home. They were not at the university. So the city figured its population would be down a bit in the 2020 census because enrollment has been down at Western Illinois University, but they did not expect as large of a drop as we saw, from about 21,500 to a shade over 15,000, Brian.
Wow, that is a huge decrease. And I guess, I don't know, does this count as something that needs full disclosure? I actually worked on a special census once, as well as a regular census, but the special was in my hometown. I think it was the summer of 96. And they, as you've said, they thought they had some growth that wasn't captured in their official decennial census numbers. I don't know whether that actually helped my hometown, which is Crete, Illinois, but has this helped Macomb in the past? You mentioned that this is something that's come up before.
Yes, it has helped. Like I say, the census is done in April. The numbers are a little bit lower. The city asks for a special census. They did one after the 2010 census. They did one after the 2000 census. They did one, I believe, after the 1990 census. It's almost really become a tradition in Macomb to have a special census done after the census is done every 10 years.
Interesting. Well, we will check in on that, I guess, in a year or two, maybe by the time we finally get some of those new numbers coming in. Emily, I'm going to come back to you. And I guess I should remind listeners, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're doing our regular Friday reporter roundtable, checking in with reporters from different parts of the state. Today, we're focusing on the communities of Macomb and the Galesburg, that entire region there in west central Illinois, as well as Champaign-Urbana. And we are joined for that by Rich Egger, who is news director at WIUM, Tri-State Public Radio, and Emily Hayes, who is a reporter with Illinois Public Media News in Champaign-Urbana. Emily, there's a factory in Urbana that is known for making those famous red Solo cups, those plastic cups that are seen in house parties, fraternity parties everywhere, I gather. And that factory is set to close. What led to that?
About a week ago, over 130 workers at the Dart factory in Urbana learned that they were losing their jobs, at least here. The company says it's about declining production value in Urbana. We had a hard time getting interviews with them. This was reported by my colleague, May Antar. They say they will offer job relocation assistance and severance for the 130 workers here. And May found that there are other Dart factories like in Georgia and Oklahoma that have closed over the past year. And they did kick her off of, she was trying to get interviews with workers or with management, and they wouldn't let her onto the property. So.
Asked her to leave. Yes. I guess I don't know if we know what is there a bigger story here? Is it competition from another company or, people using reusable cups instead of these disposable plastic ones? Or we just don't know, I guess, because she was.
Yeah, we don't know right now.
Yeah.
We'll have to watch.
Interesting. All right, Rich, coming back to you. And let's move on now to education. Western Illinois University's president made his annual start of the school year address. This happens at, I imagine, a lot of universities across the state. But what did they have to say at Western?
Well, he says sort of the theme for this year is to be bold and be unified. And he said this will be a big year for Western Illinois University. The focus will be on two major priorities. One is financial sustainability, and the other is recruitment and retention. And Western has struggled on both of those fronts in recent years.
And talk a little bit more about the recruitment problem. This is something we've seen at a lot of the directional universities here in Illinois, right?
Yeah, it's a problem because numbers are dropping. There are fewer students available. In Illinois, it seems like many college age people are leaving the state to go to universities elsewhere, or perhaps they're going right into the workforce rather than going to one of the state's public universities. So that's been a struggle for Western. It actually, enrollment has been dropping for a long time at Western, and then the problem was really exacerbated during the budget impasse in Illinois under former Governor Bruce Rauner. And the university struggled through that. It did not receive much funding, and I feel like Western was hurt perhaps more than many of the other public universities in the state by the uncertainty caused by that budget impasse. And like I say, that led, I think, to many students deciding maybe they should get a higher education in another state.
Interesting. Sticking with higher education, Emily, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in June, as we've discussed on the show, both public and private universities are not to consider race in the college admissions process. How does the University of Illinois, how are they adapting on that? I know you've been working on that.
Yeah, they said for the first time since June that they're going to use geography, socioeconomics, family education background, a host of other factors to maintain diversity. They did use race before. They have somewhat competitive admissions, especially for certain programs. So now we have the last class on campus where race has played any role in their admission. I talked to some freshmen who were concerned that this opens the door to discrimination. They pointed out it hasn't been that long since many colleges barred Black students. And affirmative action offers accountability to every racial background where you can actually see the racial demographics. And it is true that U of I admitted few Black students compared to the overall student body until the late 60s. At that point, about 1% of the student body was Black. I did also talk to students, kind of more than I expected, who were opposed to affirmative action. One student said that if students can't get in without race, they're probably struggling at school, and it's better for everyone if admissions were, quote, fair. So I looked this up a little bit, and it's not true that the study in California, there was a study in California where they previously banned affirmative action in public schools. That rerouted a lot of Black and Hispanic students to less high quality schools, and they had lower early career salaries and were less likely to graduate with STEM degrees, while the white and Asian students who replaced them didn't have better outcomes. So this paper was arguing affirmative action is a more effective use of education resources.
Mm. Well, that is a story that I'm sure will continue to develop over time, and we will keep tabs on that. We're going to take a break and come back and finish up our reporter roundtable after that. We're talking with Emily Hayes, my colleague at Illinois Public Media, as well as Rich Egger, who is with Tri-States Public Radio, WIUM in Macomb. If you want to join our conversation today, if you have a question or comment or something you are seeing in your part of Illinois, you can let us know about it at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. More to come after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are continuing our regular Friday reporter roundtable with reporters from different parts of the state. This week we're focusing on Champaign-Urbana, and we have Emily Hayes from Illinois Public Media News and Rich Egger from WIUM, Tri-States Public Radio, to talk about Macomb and Galesburg. He's the news director there. Rich, as we're coming to the end of our time together, I understand there's a former junior high school that is set to be turned into a high school there. I feel like we've had other conversations with other reporters about different repurposing of school buildings, but what's changing there? What's happening? Seems like a mini trend happening in across Illinois now.
So in the Macomb School District, actually, the building was a junior-senior high school. It was originally built to be the high school. Then it became a junior-senior high for decades. Now Macomb has opened a middle school, and this is an opportunity to remodel what had been the junior-senior high for all these years to serve exclusively as a high school. The middle school just opened a couple weeks ago to classes, brand new building, nearly $18 million to build a new middle school. And so, like I said, they're going to remodel that. Of course, classes are being held in what is now the high school, Macomb High School. This school year, faculty and staff are going to spend the year getting a feel for maybe what should be done. The building dates back to the 1970s, so it's certainly time to try and bring it into the 21st century, have it on par with that middle school, which, of course, has, you know, brand new classrooms, brand new equipment, science labs, all that sort of stuff. I'm sure, you know, a lot of that equipment is in the high school, but they have to look at ways to lay out the building now that you don't have so many grades crowded in there. And I like to say that the middle school will now have grades 6 through 8. The old junior senior high had 7 through 12. So every building in the school district is getting a little more extra space. And educators believe that's really gonna help out the students, make things just a little bit better in each of the buildings. And it is already creating kind of a new energy at the district's other schools.
Yeah, I can certainly see the need for more space. I also wonder, though, you don't hear too many more schools these days that go from grades 7 and 12 in the same building. I wonder, has anyone said that was also a factor, just kind of the socialization aspect? I mean, 7th graders can grow up quick when they have 12th graders as role models down the hall.
That's a good point. Now, a neighboring school district, the West Prairie School District, just remodeled its old middle school, and it is now a junior-senior high school. They put a little bit of an addition on it and then remodeled it. So it's like a brand new building inside too, but they sort of went the other direction, Brian. They decided they wanted to have fewer buildings to maintain in that district. So they went from having a middle school in one community and a high school in another to having a junior-senior high school, grades 7 through 12, all under the same roof.
Wow. Well, I guess that just goes to show I have no idea what I'm talking about when it comes to best practices in education. So it'll be interesting to watch and see how these things continue to develop. Rich, let's talk about arts and entertainment to wrap up our conversation here. There's a theater in Galesburg getting some renovations. What's the story there?
Well, it is the Orpheum Theater, known as the Jewel of Galesburg. Brian, it opened in 1916. Give you an idea how long ago that was. That was the first year the Cubs played in Wrigley Field. And so you've had...
Was it a vaudeville stage showing movie tones or whatever they called the reels back then?
Yeah, it was a vaudeville house when it opened out. You had performers like Houdini there in the past. I believe Groucho Marx, entertained there at one time. Through the years, you've had acts more recently, such as the Doobie Brothers and Bo Diddley. This year, there's a number of live performances scheduled there, including the Knox Galesburg Symphony. So what they've done is it's a major renovation for the Orpheum, a new set of front doors. You push button front doors. It might not sound like a big deal, but you imagine the number of people who have gone through those doors since they were installed in the late 1980s. It simply was time to replace them. They've also put a new roof over the auditorium. These are, maybe not the sort of things that are real glamorous, but they're definitely necessary if you're going to keep an old building open and functioning. And this was all done with, in part, through a Rebuild Illinois grant from the Illinois Arts Council.
Interesting, interesting. Well, nice to see some development happening there in Galesburg. Emily, I think to wrap up our conversation here and sticking with this theme of arts and entertainment, one of our colleagues at IPM News profiled a professional trumpeter who grew up in Champaign. What can you tell us about him?
Yeah, so Kimberly Schofield interviewed trumpeter James Vaughn, who grew up in Champaign, like you said. He recently finished his debut with the Grant Park Orchestra in Chicago. His mother was a professional musician, but he didn't get serious about music until he joined a Champaign-based youth orchestra. I think the part of his story that I found most compelling was that he had to take some time off from his career after high school for medical reasons, and he worked for AmeriCorps at a school in Mississippi at that time. And he rediscovered his love for trumpeting at that point, after the 9-to-5, when it's no longer work, it's now, and trumpeting was experimentative, or he was experimenting with the trumpet and it was fun. He auditioned again. He got into the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia. He had previously auditioned for music schools. And now he hopes to have a permanent job in orchestras while also working on solo projects that might combine education and music like he did in Mississippi.
You love to hear someone pursuing their passions, or perhaps especially when it's a little later than many other people find their calling. So great. Thank you for sharing that. Emily Hayes, thank you for being with us with IPM News. Rich Egger, thank you as well. Glad to have you both with us today for our weekly roundtable.